Welcome to the Omni Gamers Club podcast, the podcast for games on all platforms, including pushing a boulder up a hill for all of eternity. I am Daniel Winter.
And I'm Mark Uessa. Hello.
Hi, how are you doing, Mark?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty well. I mean, summer is finally here in Vancouver, so I'm feeling quite warm.
Yeah, it's been a little slow to hit the West Coast here, but finally made its way, which is a good excuse, of course, to hibernate and get some games in. And keeping cool, I heard you've been at the pool. My daughters are starting to swim, so we've been doing a bit of that ourselves. Still continuing our playlist streak here during the summer slump in just terms of scheduling games. If you've not listened to the previous episode, we should be returning to our usual schedule as of next episode, though. So stay tuned for that at the end of the pod. So this episode, the playlist, we're just going to be talking about some news and some of the other games we've been playing. Mark, what's news to you?
So I noticed that I always keep an eye out for HumbleBundle.com. Been a regular user, maybe even a little bit addicted to Humble Bundle for years now, for reading material, video games, of course, which started it all off. I check out the software every now and again, like game development, assets. But what has been delightful every one now and again is their RPG bundles. So quite often, you know, I like paper books, but PDFs are just fine for me most of the time. So I'm delighted to find that they have RPG bundles every month or so. And just recently they announced their RuneQuest bundle. So it's available until July 26th, which is not far from now. But you still have a little bit of time from when this episode releases. RuneQuest has been around since 1978, apparently.
Wow.
And I always confused it with ElfQuest, but it's actually turns out to be something different.
A lot of fantasy junk out there.
Yeah, but it is an older kind of venerated series. And I believe it uses the basic role-playing system, which doesn't sound very exciting, but it is the system behind games like Call of Cthulhu.
Oh, okay.
So it uses the kind of really logical, straightforward percentile-based system. So everyone's got a skill. Say you're like 23 in investigation like that. You roll percentile dice, and you succeed if you roll under 23. Pretty easy, right? Anyone can understand that.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm obviously familiar with the RuneQuest video game, or the MMO. I didn't realize it was also a TTRPG.
Yeah, are you thinking about RuneQuest or RuneScape? Because those are different things.
Maybe that's what I'm thinking of. Okay, never mind. Yeah. Scratch that.
So
so these fantasy names, they all blend together, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I believe it is RuneQuest on HumbleBundle.com, and that's the one that's been around for the 70s. So go check that out. I am still on the fence whether I need another fantasy system, but it's always nice to read some PDFs.
Excellent. Yeah, I don't really have the patience for reading PDFs, to be honest. I need the physical artifact in my hands to really have the patience to sit down and focus, right? There's too many distractions. I don't have a tablet for one thing, but so I do reading on my phone and too many distractions. So obviously it's a good option for resources. Yeah.
Yeah. I am a big proponent of tablets, not for a lot of productivity, just for reading. Like I have an iPad and I have Kindle Fire HD, which I hacked to make it Android. It is Android based, but they lock it down. It's not piracy. It's what the hardware does. It's great, especially if you use the Libby system. So the Vancouver Public Library and tons of other libraries across the world utilize, I think it's called Overdrive, to power its digital book lending. And the Libby app is just fantastic. I can get a lot of, you know, graphic novels, regular novels, magazines. It's great. So I highly recommend it for that.
Excellent. Okay, so a couple of quick news that I saw. Mattel, the mainstream game company of Barbie fame, I guess.
Barbie we don't talk about them very often. G.I. Joe, right? Yeah.
Yeah, but they announced a new accessibility campaign. They're trying to make their board games more accessible, specifically in terms of color blindness, which I know has been a growing trend in board games. And it's great to see some awareness raised in terms of that. So specifically Uno Blockus, not sure he pronounced that. And Tumbling Monkeys, I'm not familiar with. I think of the first three, Uno being the big one there, obviously. From The Verge, they stated that they're pledged to making 80% of its games colorblind accessible by the end of the year, which is a noble goal, obviously. So good to see. I mean, not all colorblind sort of techniques are equal. I'm not sure. I haven't seen any feedback as to how effective it is. But again, good to raise awareness for accessibility in games.
Right. Yeah. You could kind of say it's being a little bit cynical. Usually those games that you mentioned only have like four maybe primary colors, four major colors of the popular groups. And I think only like a couple of them conflict, like for the largest percentage of people.
Well, yeah, there's obviously different green, versions of color blindness. Yeah. Right. But I mean, that's a big conflict. Like if you can't play Uno, that's like a two out from a lot of those gatherings. Uno is still like super popular. I was speaking to someone who owns a game store saying that Uno is the most commonly stolen game.
Oh, I believe it. And it's popular around the world too, because how simple it is. So yeah, makes sense. Can't argue against making things more accessible.
Yeah. So one other Kickstarter I saw announced, I think it's live right now, called Deep Regrets. So this is a horror fishing game. There's been various fishing games, or fishing board games, I should say, that don't particularly interest me in terms of, they're playing to the realistic hobby of fishing, but this is playing into sort of folk horror, Lovecraftian, I will say. You're fishing through a deck of cards, a little bit of push your luck. You don't know exactly what's going to come up or how many eyes it's going to have. But you're rolling dice and trying to gauge what exactly you're fishing up. There's different depths of different risks, and you might the name Deep Regrets. If you fish up the wrong thing with too many tentacly bits, you can have some regrets, basically. But there's various upgrades and things that you can sort of. They're like engine building with upgrading your boat and your equipment. So a really cool art aesthetic, a bit of hand-drawn inked art. And yeah, it's a great little indie game. It's reminiscent of a video game I'll be talking about a little later. So I've been very interested in that vibe. Just a very unique aesthetic. The dice you're rolling are basically, I think they're D4s, but they're shaped, they're wooden and shaped like the fishing buoys. So it's a really cool little touch.
Very nice. I don't know if I've ever told you, but I have an irrational distaste for D4 dice. Which is okay. Funny because pyramids are naturally beautiful. They're a very harmonious platonic solid.
A little too harmonious to roll cleanly, though.
Yeah, I think
they don't want to be rolled.
Precisely. They don't want to be rolled. They're the most awkward, and I suspect their level of randomness, you know, unless you roll it with a fine degree, I fear that people can game D4 rolls, but that's just my irrational
drop it
feeling. Right. Speaking of video games though, I have a little bit of news, which I just took advantage of. I think I threatened to do it an episode or two ago, but I bit the bullet and I subscribed to the Ubisoft Plus annual subscription, yes, because they had a big promotion recently. It just ends on July 11th, so that date might have already passed by the time this episode comes out. But basically, they took 25% off the annual rate. Mm-hmm. It's $150 Canadian for a whole year, and that includes some of the forthcoming games like Assassin's Creed Shadows, which I'm interested in because it's set in Japan, and Star Wars Outlaws. So there's two big day one games. Actually, it's early. Like Xbox Game Pass, they're releasing games early on that platform. So it's better than day one. Wow. So for those two games alone, $150 didn't seem too bad. But because I don't usually play Ubisoft games, I have a bunch that I haven't played that I'm moderately curious about.
Fair.
So, yeah.
Yeah, so I guess this is playing into this. We spoke a little bit last episode about you know, platforms, so software being the new platform. So this is obviously increasing towards that trend of you don't own games anymore, right? You're buying a temporary lease to a game. Oh, sorry, temporary license, I guess. And yeah, I don't know that I like that long term. In terms of where that's pushing the industry, but it's for now we do have more options. I just don't like hoping it doesn't become the only option before long.
Yeah, the funny thing with that is that you're buying access to a game license, whether you buy it on Steam or Xbox or Switch, even the cartridge or the disc. There's no guarantee that that will work 15 years from now in the future, especially without an internet connection, right? I think, what's the big deal? Like Battlefield 1942 is just being, just ending its lifespan among a few other EA online titles right now. So that's the big buzz. Yeah, you're basically anything you buy now on a digital marketplace is not guaranteed to be there in 10, 15 years.
We've all put a lot of faith that Steam will always be there.
Steam? Or iTunes, or I mean, Spotify is a bit different because you pay month to month, but everything that's sold digitally is no guarantee. There's no guarantee.
Crunchyroll. No, it was a competitor to Crunchyroll who got bought out, and anything you'd purchase from that did not roll across. You just lose those purchases.
Yeah, that's right. I think it was Funimation.
That's the one. Yes.
When they merged with Crunchyroll, yeah, I don't think there was any compensation either.
Nope.
Yeah,
capitalism gonna do its thing.
That's gotta hurt. Okay, shall we talk about what we've been playing recently?
Sure, let's jump into the playlist. What have you been playing lately?
Okay, let's see. So I've been playing a couple of video games that are pretty fresh to me. I think I might have gotten them through sales recently. Definitely one of them I did. So 20 Minutes Till Dawn. Have you heard of this one?
No. I'm guessing it's zombie related?
Kind of. I think there might be vampires or something involved there. But it's a garlic-like. So it is Vampire Survivors. Pretty much Vampire Survivors to a T. It does have a couple of twists, though, which manage to hook me. Because I am actually a fan of Vampire Survivors. We, of course, did our whole episode about it. I play it with my family, with my kids. So I'm a supporter of the genre, but I haven't tried too many others. I guess I mentioned Deep Rock Galactic Survivors the other day.
Yeah, so I was trying to think of the garlic like you mentioned last week. Okay.
Yeah, which is very polished. That one is really nice, and I'll definitely go back to that for sure. Mm-hmm. But 20 Minutes Till Dawn, I just had to try it out, and it got its hooks in me. And for a couple of reasons why it's cool is that it's short. 20 minutes, shorter than 30 minutes, which is the typical Vampire Survivors length. And even faster than that, they have a compressed 10-minute mode. Oh. So if you just want a quick run, you can do that. It has a cast of characters you can unlock, of course. It has a number of weapons that you can unlock. So you can unlock the weapons separately from the characters, mm-hmm. which is nice. It has your rogue light permanent... just improvements.
Okay.
As Vampire Survivors did. But unlike Vampire, this game offers manual control. So not only are you walking around manually, but you're also shooting manually. So it's like a cross between a twin stick shooter, not exactly twin stick shooter because you are pulling a trigger, but you're manually moving, manually shooting, plus you have automatic helper weapons that go off every now and again. So I feel like it has just enough twists to make it interesting. And it has this really nice kind of monochromatic, duochromatic color palette, which I think is really quite stylish. So I'd say so far I'm enjoying it, and I'll probably keep playing it a bit.
What platform is this on?
I'm playing it on Steam, but it's probably on console as well. Plays perfectly with gamepad controls.
Yeah, I'm curious if any of these are on like Android or on phone, it tends to be the sort of place you have the time to play these games. But it sounds like with the extra control, like having to fire manually probably wouldn't be a good fit. So
yeah, it would be a great match for like Switch. I'm sure it could run it with the really low kind of spec graphics. It would be great for a plane flight, even a couple of hour flight. You could pass half that time very easily. So yeah, 20 minutes till dawn, I recommend.
Excellent. Cool. Well, I've mostly been playing, diving into a lot of the longer games as the summer goes on, trying to get through that backlog. I've been playing a little bit more Yakuza Like a Dragon. That game just keeps going. Still some Lords of the Fallen, which we've spoken about a little bit. Starting to hit a few more pain points in that game as the game goes further on, is getting more difficult, and it is pulling more of those gotcha moments. It does feel like every single, like the base of that game is really solid, I think, but every area has some kind of just some really annoying feature, whether it's, oh, it's invisible archers, oh, it's the traditional poison swamp, or it's dudes will just push you off the boardwalks, hiding behind a crate. So yeah, a lot of frustration points as the game goes on. I'm still enjoying the core mechanics of it though, so I'm trying to push through that. We'll see if I get through it. Well, one new game I've been trying out though, as hinted earlier, similar to Deep Regrets, that was it, was Dredge. So this is the video game came out, I think, last year, fairly recently. Again, fishing game with a horror theme. You are basically, you're playing a fisherman. You play from the perspective of the boat. It's like a basically third person boat as it's sailing around these islands. It's kind of like sort of Wind Waker. You've got this large series of islands that you're sailing around, collecting fish. There's various little mini games for collecting fish or dredging up sort of equipment from some shipwrecks, and you can sell the fish, you can buy new equipment, all pretty straightforward stuff. Except some of those fish that you, again, similar to Deep Regrets, some of those fish are going to have extra eyes or just look at you a little funny, shall we say. So, or there's the ghost ships that appear. Don't be fishing out too late at night. You may see some more grisly sights. So, again, fairly simple. You have the standard sort of progression system. Oh, you've got faster engines, you've got bigger nets, you're more hold space. But there's a few various storylines going alongside that. You get passengers sometimes to take to go to various places. You've got someone looking for particular artifacts from shipwrecks. There's a few different threads to pull at here. So lots of little friction moments to sort of trying to balance everything out, because you've only got a certain amount of time each day. So are you going to just go fishing and get a bunch of fish, or are you going to go exploring and look for new islands, or follow one of those other storylines? And it's really satisfying, because a day is only like probably a few minutes. It's pretty short, all things considered. So is that one of those games where it's like, oh, just one more day. So it has a great momentum in that sense, and a great vibe. Said there's some of those villagers a little suspicious, especially the ones dressed in weird cultist robes, inexplicably. So having fun with that, seeing it's only going to get spookier from here, I imagine. So yeah, enjoying Dredge.
Yeah, it seems like there's a natural connection between fishing and horror for some reason. I think there was that, what was that board game you were talking about? Sleeping Gods or something like that?
Yes, yeah. That wasn't so much the horror as what you fished. That was more of an exploration adventure game. It was definitely playing, I mean, if looking at the cover, it was definitely playing with the Leviathan beneath the waves. But it wasn't particularly horrific. This is definitely playing on the fear of the unknown.
Right. And then not horror, but the other popular fishing game out right now is the Dave the Diver, right?
Yeah. So this and Dave the Diver have both been compared. I don't know a lot about Dave, other than apparently it's about 10 times as long. So that was probably the biggest factor in me choosing Dredge. It's just I want to be able to finish the game, right?
Yeah. Dave the Diver is surprisingly popular, and everyone says good things about it. Although apparently it's like quite like fat phobic or something like that. And they really kind of...
Interesting.
They really poop on Dave, the main character, or something like that for some reason. So that didn't appeal to me, but I haven't played it myself, so I can't say one way or another.
Yeah, I mean, these games, because it was both Dredge and Deep Regrets, both play with the sort of madness mechanics, which can also be a bit of a touchy subject. Right. I mean, I say with a box of Mansions of Madness behind me here, not always treated with the most respect, that theme. I think Dredge does it pretty, it hasn't really become explicit with it. It's just you just see a little eye appears when you start to lose your nerve a little.
Right. Yeah, I think if you boil it down, all, you know, Cthulhu inspired content comes from a time gone by, let's just say, an era where tastes and attitudes and certainly perspectives and opinions about different types of people, be they different ethnicities or be they different intellectual capacities or psychological states, weren't really handled very well. And that's why I try and stay away from most Cthulhu themed.
Not the least things. By Lovecraft himself. Yeah, that's kind of baked in, and it's taken a lot of time to sort of extract any of the more worthwhile elements from the inherent fear of the other, right? And not make it problematic.
Right. But there are, I do recognize that there are new generations of people taking it on as their own thing. And obviously, at some point, it's literally gone into the public domain. Right.
Yes. And from what I've seen, Dredge is treating that fairly respectfully. I haven't seen anything yet. So that's problematic, by the way.
Very cool. I'm going to mention one more video game that I played, which is probably touches on some problematic subject matter. But it's a Spike Chunsoft game, which I love that publisher. They do some really wild, off-the-wall stuff.
I remember that name. I can't recall what they've made.
Zanki Zero, I'm not sure if you've seen the artwork, has this like very kind of colorful like ocean scene of like a bunch of colorful anime style survivors. There's 8 survivor main characters in this game, and basically it's sort of this end of the world but with a bit of a mystery. Like, you see these like ruined islands with you know, like bombed out towers and things, like very post-apocalyptic but on a sunny tropical island. So this game has a lot of conflicting themes and genres and imagery going on to it. And let me just say, spoiler, it's like a real hoot how they've combined all this stuff. So I'll give you the elevator pitch. This game is along the lines of a Danganronpa or a 999 style game, as in it's got a small cast of characters, really wacky character designs. It's a what's called a death game, or like a sort of a cruel game of kidnap characters in a tense scenario, and it's a mystery.
Very high concept, then.
Yeah, and I can't resist a mystery, but this game blends a visual novel storytelling with basically Etrian Odyssey style grid based dungeon delving.
Okay, now you have my attention.
And the dungeon delving takes place on these abandoned tropical islands. So the dungeons that you're mapping out might just literally be out in the world on this sunny island. And you're scavenging things. Oh, also, did I mention it's a survival game where you have to manage your hunger and your stress level and your bladder capacity? So you're doing things like collecting water bottles, sticks, rope, car batteries, paper, things like that. And it also has very dark horror and body horror elements. So I just got through the prologue. I've only played it, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 hours. And it's kind of got me. It's kind of got me. Okay. By its story twists. So I won't say any more. Let me just say this is a super kooky game, and I love it. I love everything about it so far.
Yeah, I like the sound of the exploration. I'm curious how linear that element would be with the... I mean, those visual novels tend to be have a pretty linear, if not branching, progression.
Yeah, I liked how the 999 series does the branching because it does it is sort of like a choose your own adventure, but it encourages you to go through all the branches.
Okay.
And tell the story in very different ways and kind of show different facets of all the characters. This one, because I've just started, it's hard to say, but the areas are sort of small, as in I haven't explored the starting island, but it seems very small. And then even within the prologue, after sleeping for the first night, another island mysteriously rolls up to next to your island. So, like, there's mysteries all around, right? But of course, the new island is a dungeon itself.
Hmm.
So new dungeons are added to the mix.
Very cool. Yeah. In a similar vein, I've been thinking lately about how much I like the game Paradise Killer. I've not played this recently, but it was, I think I saw it was on sale and it was reminding me. But it's a visual novel sort of with a murder mystery. Like, yeah. It's an open world. You're wandering around, but then talking to the various characters around and trying to solve this mystery. Very cool vaporwave cyberpunk sort of aesthetic.
Right. But
probably the coolest sound, like in the sense of it is cool, right? Capital C soundtrack that I regularly listen to outside of the game. So very cool vibes. That's Paradise Killer. So if you're into those sort of games, I'd recommend checking that out.
Yeah, I got to play that game. I know that it was on Game Pass for a while, and I just didn't get to it. And I'm sure it's available for a pretty decent price, especially on Steam sales.
Yes. Yeah. Excellent.
Very nice. Any other games you've been playing video game wise?
No. I said mostly trying to get through that backlog.
All right, let's move on to the analog games. How about?
Yeah, I have been playing a few more games on the table this last week. With the summer heat, I've been trying to make some more time to play some games with my daughter, who's like five now, and so getting a little more open-minded to what she's willing to play and having a bit more patience with learning games. So I brought out a new one this last week called Diced Veggies. So this is from KTBG, I think is the initials. Yeah, this is the family imprint of Burnt Island Games. And so I meant to pick this up last year at PAX U, but they sold out. And it's only just made its way to Canada. So this is as you mentioned from the name, you have a bunch of dice, like 60 dice, representing various veggies. Like there's five colors. For carrots, onions, peppers, and so on. And so you basically form this grid of dice. I think it's like 10 by 6 thereabouts dice. And then you have this giant cardboard cleaver that you're you're sort of pushing out several chunks of dice at a time. As if this was some monstrous mutant vegetable of all merged together, but you're cutting off various dice that represent different vegetables. The trick is, like, these dice have ranging from 2 to 6 pips, and you can only cut between, you have to cut in such a way the dice are 10 or less pips.
Hmm.
So you could grab 1 6 and a 4, or you grab I don't think the cleaver is big enough to grab 5 dice, but you could grab, say, 4 2s. And you've got various recipe cards that are that want particular types of dice or particular colors. And so the recipe fulfillment is pretty straightforward. Just collect these colored dice and trade them in. There are some other cards that will give you, that will tweak it. It's like, oh, it's Uncle Joe's famous chili, or it's the easy weeknight chili. that will sort of change it in such a way. Oh, you get extra points if you use all twos, or if the total is more than 19 or something like that. So it's a few tweaks there, but the core mechanic is pretty simple. This is a family game, and I've been playing it with my daughter without those extra layers, just the base recipe cards, because she's obsessed with maths right now, just constantly quoting maths at me. And so I thought this would make good practice. And so she's been enjoying that element, without all of the craft of the extra mechanics, just focusing on that core of slicing off the dice. And that is just such an inherently cool thematic element, like the big cleaver, chopping up dice, moving. Like it's a very tactile game. And that core element is such a fun puzzle. It's not always necessarily balanced. Like I played it with some friends at 4 players. Ran a little long, didn't entirely feel balanced, but it's a family weight game, and that core element is fun enough to carry it.
Nice, yeah. I like games that have that extra layer that you can add to it to make it like a, you know, complex, quote unquote, game. You know, like Agricola has that, right? Like, it's basically a totally different game, but the core mechanics of it are actually quite simplistic if you break it down. And then the occupation and the improvement cards make it, you know, that's its special sauce. So
yeah, I mean, add that this stuff is later. What you traditionally think of as house rules, but the rules specifically lay out, oh, if you're playing with younger kids, you might want to leave out these elements. And so it's allowing that, you don't have to feel like you're cheating or like playing wrong, right? It's allowing that freedom to mess with the rules and find the right balance for, especially with kids, as they get older, can handle different levels of complexity. That's diced veggies.
That's great. Very cool. I'm just going to mention one game because I did manage to play a board game in the physical space.
Congratulations.
Yes, of course, I played lots of my regular games in the digital space. But I didn't play an RPG this week because a few people are away. I went to my neighbors and we decided to play a board game, and I brought a few. I brought Terraforming Mars, Shadowrun Crossfire. Have you ever played that one?
Name's familiar. I don't know anything about it.
Yeah, it's actually kind of cool. It's like a cooperative card management, like hand management game, where you have to tackle these sort of quests, which you collaboratively do just by like basically playing cards on your turn or lending out cards, playing cards on someone else's turn. So it's sort of like trade-offs. And the game progressively gets harder over time. I thought we were going to play that one because it's an RPG-oriented group, right? But the one they ended up going for, because there was like one neighbor who was there who was not an RPG player, and they wanted something shorter. So the other third game that I brought along with me was The Quest for El Dorado. So that's it's a Kinitsia game, right? It's a Reiner Kinitsia.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a Reiner Kinitsia deck building game, but with a really cool, I think, well done theme, which is not very common for Kinitsia games, I would say. Basically, it's a race. Every mission, every play of that game is a race from one end of the map to the goal. There's a literal starting point, starting tile, and a literal ending tile. And you can basically form these island tiles, of which there are something like 6 or 8 inside the box, and they're double-sided too.
Mm.
So you can flip them, and they're roughly, they're basically large hunks of hexes. So you can configure them in a lot of different ways, almost infinite ways, but the game comes with like recommended
preset layouts,
arrangements of them. Yeah, so it's really smart. And we just played the most simplest arrangement of the island tiles, which I've played multiple times, but I still enjoy. And it comes with like very limited set of cards, but I think it adds a lot of dynamism. It's a great intro to deck building games because the cards are fairly straightforward. Because
there's like a lot of text, right? It's mostly just like numeric upgrades.
Yeah, about half of the cards are just those numeric upgrades. Basically, they correspond to the type of terrain on the island you're trying to traverse. Mm. So there's green machetes for forest, jungle. There's a yellow coin for these village tiles, I guess you're kind of trading with locals, or you also use the yellow coin cards for buying cards that you add to your deck. And then there's blue ores for the water sections, obviously. And then the cards that kind of do the special effects are these purple cards, and they're the ones that have like maybe like one or two sentences of text on them. And like a couple of them were a little hard to explain because the people I was playing with didn't really understand the concept of deck building in general. I think they got it over the time. They were like, well, why would I want to get rid of a card that I have? And I tried to explain, well,
struggle with that. Like, I want all the cards. Give me cards. More cards.
Yeah.
The bigger the deck, the better.
The temptation is to get more, right? Yeah, everyone wants more. More is good is what our instinct tells us. But if you burn a low power card, then you're more likely to see the high power cards.
Yes.
So I had to explain that to them a couple times, but they got it in time. And that game constantly surprised me. Because I'm not going to explain it all because people can go check it out if they want to. But it's basically a race. And I kind of shot out pretty far early. Mm. There's these couple of spaces on the board that let you... Some spaces on the board, I think they're called caves, let you pick up these one-time use tiles, which are face down. And they contain symbols like the cards do. So the symbol might let you walk on jungles for two spaces, or give you two machetes, essentially, or two ores, or let you burn a card from your deck. So I told them about that, and I told them about the spaces that let you burn the cards from your deck. And they're sort of off on the edges, so you have to kind of go out of your way to get to those spaces. So my theory was, I will invest in those early, I'll burn the low power cards from my deck, and I'll just really, like, my engine will be super optimized by the second half of the game. And lo and behold, I got out really far to about the midpoint of the course. And then my engine totally stalled. I spent all this time buying these purple cards and I didn't have enough blue ores to get me past just like the smallest touch of water. And I totally stalled. Everyone blazed right past me. And basically, the person that was in last place, the non-role-playing game player, who was sort of insinuating that I was, you know, taking advantage of knowing the game or playing it before, this player shot out front. And the other player, who's the GM, Paul, I think he was grasping the rules of the game fairly well. I think he might have thrown the game because he was sort of in the lead. And I think he intentionally just stayed a couple of steps from the final goal. And then the very person in the very end, last place, shot out to front, won the game, and everyone had a blast.
Excellent.
So yeah. I had egg on my face because I thought I was going to kill it. But I was shown my proper place by getting last place in that game I'd played before.
You didn't mean to do that at all, of course, not to like build up their confidence.
No, I mean, I don't know. I probably pulled a couple of punches, light punches here or there, but usually I play it to win.
I was going to ask like how this game is with sort of that runaway leader effect, because racing games are so hard to balance that. I've been playing a bit of Heat lately, and Heat feels like it goes so far the other way of rubber banding to keep everyone together that it can sometimes feel redundant. Like if there's so many things forcing everyone to stay together, then what's the point of having the race, right?
Is it like the Mario Kart blue shell problem?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah. So this game, I think it only has one sort of nod to slowing down the lead person at the front, is that I told you that there's those map tiles and each of them is like a bunch of hexes. Basically at the border where each one of the tiles, larger tiles, meets, there's a kind of a zigzaggy extra piece of cardboard that gets dealt out, I think randomly, and placed down. And basically you deal them out randomly and you flip them up. And everyone is aware of these from the start of the game, and I did explain the rules for them. Whoever reaches that border first has to pay extra to basically get rid of this barrier.
Okay.
So it basically penalizes the person.
You're going to blaze that
trail. Right, exactly. Yeah, it penalizes the player who's up front. So theoretically, it slows them down, and then the other players have a chance to catch up. And another thing this game does really well that is outside of the deck building is that you can block people because there's literally people in front of you and you can't walk through other people.
Like bottlenecks?
There are some obvious bottlenecks depending on player strategies. And if they bought the right cards that get them through that certain type of terrain, then you just feel like a genius for having planned so well in advance, right? So it's very smart. I think it's a very flexible system, and I think it has at least one expansion.
I think it's got several. I've seen like three or four boxes of expansions for that.
Yeah, I've had this game for a couple, two, 3 years now, everyone's enjoyed it that I played it with, and I have never felt the need to buy one of those expansions because I play it so rarely. It's just nice and pleasant every time I play it.
Sometimes there's a lot of elegance in just that, you know, Reiner Knizia game, obviously. He pulls a lot of replayability out of this elegant variant without having to add a lot of craft and new stuff.
Right. And once again, it's ironically, rarely very thematic for a Reiner Knizia game. And I think they do it well.
Excellent. Yeah. We did play it at one point years ago, but I'd like to revisit that one sometime.
Yeah. It's cute.
Cool. Okay, one other game I want to talk about is I recently returned to an old favorite. That is Paladins of the West Kingdom. So this is the second game in the West Kingdom trilogy, the first being Architects of the West Kingdom that we also covered for a previous episode. Go check that out. And then followed up by Viscounts, I think, was the third. So this was the first of the three that I'd played. But there was an expansion for this game that I had not played. I've played all the other expansions of all the other games. This is the final one. I'm closing the book on all of the content for the West Kingdom with the final expansion, the City of Crowns for Paladins of the West Kingdom. So yeah, this is I really like this game. It's simple, but it's very different from Architects, whereas that was a very heavily interactive worker placement game where you're rounding up other players' workers and sending them to jail and buying them back and a lot of back and forth. Whereas this is an extremely solitaire game. There's a couple of points where you interact, like trying to buy cards from the shared market. You might be a bit of a race to get that. A couple of shared spaces in the middle of the board, but mostly you've got these personal boards. It feels very much like a roll and write game. Even though there's no, you have physical boards, physical pieces, but you're plugging your work. You have workers of various colors, and you're plugging them down into these preset spaces, sort of matching the colors where possible to get various effects, unlocking permanent upgrades, and sort of putting out these tokens, filling in spaces. So it feels very much scratching a very similar itch to a roll and write game, but you've got all these tactile pieces. The cool thing really is, though, is that there's this paladins mechanic where basically you draw three, you have a small deck of cards. You're only going to get through the deck once over the course of the game, but you draw three cards, you keep one, put one on the top and one on the bottom. And that one, it's a very simple mechanic, but there's so many decisions in that one core element at the start of each turn, because each card has like three, it's got like two colored meeples to determine what meeples you're going to have for that round. It's got some temporary stats to increase your attributes for that round, which will help you do some actions. It's got a bonus effect, which might make certain type of actions cheaper that round. So there's three, every card has you doing three different things. So it's this really juicy decision of what you're going to prioritize for that round, what you're going to set up for the next round, what card you don't really care about, maybe set it up for the end of the game. And then you're also drafting these four... So you're drafting this card, which will give you four meeples of various colors. And so between those two sort of drafts, you're getting your collection of meeples for the round. So it's going to be a bit of a mismatch what you're working with. They're very improvised. Like the start of each round is you're very, very much improvised, like random cards coming out to give you random meeples. But then from that point on, it's an extremely deterministic game. You can basically plan out your entire turn, assuming that you're not going for one of those shared spaces. So I find that puzzle really fascinating. Like each round, you get an assortment of meeples and you have to improvise, what am I going to do with these? How can I be most efficient with them? So it's a really really interesting balance of improvisation and long-term strategy. Like, really like that game. So then you've got City of Crowns expansion that comes in. So this it shakes things up quite a bit in that it adds a fourth attribute. You've got there were three stats that you're pushing up, and most of the actions will give you one, will require one attribute and give you another. And you've got to kind of stagger these attributes as the game goes on. Now it's adding a fourth to balance, which is diplomacy, which actually adds a lot of variability in that most of these new cards, it adds this whole new market of cards that give you secondary ways of performing all the other actions in the game. And so now you've got multiple ways of achieving the same effect, which adds a whole lot of more variety to the game, obviously. Like, it gives you more ways of achieving your goals. So you can get some really clever combos going on there. It's tough. I think, objectively, it's a better game with this. but it also makes it more like the other games in the series, like a less deterministic experience, a less solitaire experience, because you're now jostling for these cards collectively. That's more interactive, but it's taking the game away from what was special about Paladins of the West Kingdom. So I think it's objectively a better experience as a standalone game, but it's making it less unique compared to the other games in the trilogy. So I'm a little torn on it. I think it's I don't know that I'd always play with it. I think that the core game is such a strong puzzle, but if you're looking to mix things up a bit, it's definitely a solid option there.
Yeah, these West Kingdom games, I can picture Architects fairly well, because we covered that, obviously, and I played it probably the most of the three. I've never not played Viscounts, and I'm pretty sure I played Paladins at least once or twice, but I cannot picture it. I cannot remember my experience with it. That's the problem with me and these games, is that I cannot keep these entries in the series apart.
The problem, all of these games I really love. One of the biggest problems I find, though, is that within that trilogy, there's a lot of similar iconography, similar characters. Like everyone has like these decks of cards that you're drafting cards into your sort of tableau. But they all have the same characters. They're doing different things in each game. The same symbols will appear, but it'll have different effects in each game. And so unless you're playing them regularly, it's really hard to internalize what the difference between debt, like what does debt do in Architects versus Paladins versus Viscounts? And they're so similar, but differentiate themselves in small ways that can really throw you.
Yeah, it's a shared design language, right? I know what they do with it. And it's also branding, obviously, of the West Kingdom, North Sea, whatever. That's a branding thing more than anything, and it sort of sells the next entry in the game in its own right. So I can see why they do that, but because like this isn't like a linear tale like in a movie or book trilogy, you're not just moving on from that point, right? And then the character enters a new arc. You literally are confused between what this icon means in each iteration of the game. And I think that's a disservice to game players, in that they lose that sort of visibility, that transparency in what a design element means. It's like an anti-affordance. So I don't know if that's a really positive thing in terms of game design. No knock on them, because obviously they have a lot of success, but I don't naturally get attracted to that publisher's games of that type. How many have there been? Like 10?
Oh, I mean, there was the three in the North Sea trilogy, three in the West Kingdom trilogy. Now there's at least two in the next trilogy. I've only played the first of those, and it really doubles down on the complexity and lots of symbols, lots of symbols to interpret that I just don't think is quite consistent enough, and a little too much complexity for complexity's sake, and spinning too many plates was a bit much. But I think the West Kingdom trilogy is really the sweet spot for me. Viscounts is probably still my favorite. I think it's the most unique of the three in terms of having it. Like, it's got this rondelle that you're running around, and like it's just a fascinating sort of ecosystem where it's an indirect interaction, whereas Architects was very direct. I'm literally going and sending your workers to jail. Viscounts is very much just indirectly getting in each other's way and just manipulating the board state and it's changing the board state in subtle ways that it's forcing you to recalculate each round in some really, really fun ways. So I think that's probably still my favorite. So Architects with the expansion, I think it's the Artisans expansion, that's probably my favorite expansion of the trilogy.
more to confuse me anyway.
Yes,
but I'll give Viscounts a shot though. That one did seem interesting to me when it was coming out.
Sure, it's we should do the Tome Saga sometime. It's like a meta game where you play all three of them in a row.
Oh geez, please, yeah, give me some time to build myself up emotionally for that first. Very nice. Any other board games or analog games you've been playing?
No, I think that's about it for me. I've been still picking away at the Portal at House on the Hill, which I discussed last episode, playing a few more games of Floor Plan to sort of as prep work for that. We're in the early stages of prepping another TTRPG. I don't think we're quite ready to announce that yet, but we're sort of reading up and doing some preparatory work. So stay tuned for that.
Absolutely. I'm always excited to play another new RPG. Shall we? Oh, we know what game we're playing next episode.
We do. Yes. We've been teasing it for a while now.
Right. Which once again is A Feast for Odin from famed game designer Uwe Rosenberg. And mm-hmm. are we announcing who our guest will be for the episode?
I think we are, yeah, in case anyone wants to send in any questions. And so we'll be joined by Olivia Lothery, known as Oloplays on social media. You may know from, she's worked for several publishers and distributors in the game space, and also big into the wargaming scene. So curious to get some perspective there. When we decided to cover another Uwe game, she was obviously the first person we thought of, big Uwe fan. So, looking forward to her perspective. If you have any questions for her or for us on any on A Feast for Odin or any other games we've been playing, you can contact us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or at our website, omnigamers.club.
We'd be happy to hear your feedback. It always energizes us to produce more episodes in the future. And of course, do check us out. If you haven't yet, watch our videos on YouTube. We put these videos out in episodes out in video form every week now.
Yes, it is. You can see my dog has been quite restless tonight and been running around. So from a divergence from Ted the cat, who's usually bothering us. slight change of schedule today.
Very nice. All right. So next episode, we're talking Feast for Odin.
Excellent. Thanks for joining us in the club here. And remember to have a balanced diet of games.
Goodbye.
Bye.